Hello and welcome to the Tabletop Bellhop Gaming Podcast, episode 240, Add-ons and Upgrades, Fan-Created Improvements for Board Games and RPGs.
So tonight we've got an interesting question about our favorite fan-made tabletop accessories. We follow that with a talk about the games we've been playing, which includes Pirate Tales, Holotype, Gelatinous, Matches, and the Artemis Project with its expansion. More importantly, though, we do have some first thoughts on Kitten and Vinyl Jukebox. Then we've got three reviews for tonight. Deep dives into Holotype Mesozoic North America, the Art Project, and the Satellites and Commanders expansion for the Artemis Project.
Before we get into all that, though, some introductions. I'm Sean, your host, and here with me, we have our Instagram Reel Master, Deanna.
Hey, folks.
And the Tabletop Bellhop himself, Mo T.
I am Mo 2-0, the Tabletop Bellhop, your cardboard concierge, helping you make your game nights better.
Show up Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern at twitch.tv/tabletopbellhop to watch us record this podcast live.
You can find detailed show notes, including links to games and other things we talk about tonight at tabletopbellhop.com/episode240. That's 240. Some of those may be affiliate links, which,
What's wrong with that?
Oh, never mind. It said May twice, and then I thought it didn't belong there. That's what happens when I read things. All right. Find detailed show notes, including links to games and other things we talk about tonight at tabletopbellhop.com/episode240. That's 240. Some of those links may be affiliate links, which cost you nothing at all to use, but help cover things like hosting costs.
I'm pretty sure you said May once you got rid of the May.
Yeah, well, I give up.
Many of the games we mentioned tonight were provided by publishers in the form of review copies.
The Tabletop Bellhop is here to answer your gaming and game night questions. Tonight's question comes from Ryan Peach, who clicked Ask the Bellhop over at tabletopbellhop.com to ask, what are some of your specific favorite content, components, or accessories created for games by fans? I'm thinking of things like rule summaries, player aids, box and component storage, 3D objects and component replacements, variants, and expansions. While there are companies that make such things to sell, I'm thinking of those who make such things as a labor of love for a game that they like and who give their files away to be shared with fellow fans.
Oh, that's a cool question. Thanks for sending that in, Ryan.
I got to say, it's awesome that Ryan is here in our chat room here on Twitch, so we'll get to hear our answer live. So thank you for the question. So honestly, I love this question. This is a great one. This is a good way for us to point out to our fellow gamers some of the coolest stuff we've found. So I got to admit, it did take me a bit of thinking. This is one of those ones where I'm like, oh, yeah, of course, there's tons. We have so much fan creation. There's all kinds of stuff I've added to my games. Like, wait, those Terraforming Mars things. Okay. I don't know what it was. It was just one of those. I'm like, I know we have lots, but it took me a bit to actually come up with any.
So I admit, I get a little put off sometimes when I have this nice, highly professional game and fan content for it is, well, less than professional.
Yeah.
So I tend to avoid a lot of this when it comes to the summaries and expansions and player aids, but some of the components, the organizers and things like that out there really are amazing.
Well, I'd argue that there are some pretty solid fan created stuff for summaries and player aids, though full on expansions make me jittery, but scenarios can be cool.
Yeah, and I can't help but also think of RPGs here, especially back in the D&D 3.0 days with the glut of OGL content and the quality, which ranged from terrible to fantastic. Now, before we get to some of our favorite game upgrades and components and updates, I want to call out one thing on Ryan's question. Though Ryan specifically says, while there are companies that make these, he was thinking of those who make them as a labor of love for games they love and give the files away. Now, I appreciate that. I get it. And I understand looking for things created from really love, but I personally want to broaden the scope here because honestly, I think we want to talk about all upgrades and content, free or not. Yes, a list of free stuff you can get is cool. But for this one, I think the big companies, like the companies like the box insert companies nowadays, honestly, are fans that are making things for fans. I think they're fans themselves. I don't think the board game industry or RPG industry is big enough for someone to come in and start a company to fill a small niche to exploit the fans, right? Like, I think all of this stuff is coming as a labor of love from someone.
And as well, people should just be paid for their work. So whether or not you're doing something as a labor of love, to reach a certain level of quality and to make it actually a valuable addition has taken someone work and effort. And whether you're paying them in cold hard cash, Geek Gold on BoardGameGeek or, you know, resharing their content because you love it. Content creators deserve to get paid.
There are some really cool things coming out from individual creators that are making upgrades and add-ons for board games. And yes, they should be paid for their efforts.
Now, the other thing I do want to bring people's attention to, now this is going way back, where we're jumping into the 13th floor, getting in the elevator and going back in time a little too far, probably. But check out episode 17 of the Tabletop Bellhop Gaming Podcast, Accessory to Gaming. On that episode, we talk about our favorite game accessories. And also there's a related blog post, which is what are some must-have tabletop gaming accessories? Now, there is some overlap between this topic and that one. And I think people looking for answers to Ryan's questions may find something of interest there. But the thing is, what you're going to see there is stuff that isn't necessarily fan-created. It's like, you know, wooden bowls for component organization and a laminator. That's not the stuff that's going to fit here, but I think there's going to be some stuff there that will also be applicable tonight.
All right, well, let's get to some of our favorite upgrades for games.
Okay, so the first one that came to mind is Terraforming Mars. If you ever played the base game, you know, the sheet where your player board, where you put your bits out, it gets knocked all the time. And there was an Etsy person that started selling overlays where you have a two-layer board and the cubes would slot in. And eventually, they made official ones for Terraforming Mars, but I got these years ago before they put out that upgrade. And I bought them for Mo for Christmas, and I will find the link and drop it into the show notes because that person has other cool add-ons for board games on their site, and I cannot remember their Etsy handle at the moment. But yeah, that was the first thing that I was like, this is such a simple upgrade to be able to just have these cubes slotted in and not sliding around, but it was a big thing. And obviously, they thought it was cool because they ended up adapting it and making official ones.
Yeah, those ones in particular I liked because you just put them over the existing boards. They weren't replacement boards. You didn't have to slot the other boards inside. They didn't, like, I don't know, like, completely surround it. Like, there was all kinds of different ones out there. These were nice and simple. They're in player colors, a little strip you put on the middle of your board, and that way, if you got bumped, your cubes didn't go everywhere. I totally agree. That was one of the first things I thought of as well.
And when we got the new ones, we liked the old ones better. When we got the new official upgrades, we put them aside and just kept using the old ones. Yeah.
Next up, I got to call out box inserts in general, except for the box insert curse. There's a lot of people doing these. There are companies that do these. That is their main business now, is creating box inserts and board game organization for inside the box. But going way back again, quite a few years ago, we got a copy of Food Chain Magnet. Loved Food Chain Magnet. And then someone on Board Game Geek, who at the time just used like a bandsaw, had created this awesome way to organize the cards so that they were displayed. While someone else who was a little more skilled and had a laser cutting machine went on to create a full box insert for it so that you had all the component organization, all your hamburgers are separated from your pizzas, and then you had this tray that goes over top that held all your cards. This was groundbreaking to me, first of all, because the whole concept of box inserts were fairly new. People were doing some fun stuff with foam core, but a wooden box insert was a new idea. But more importantly, this was something that made the game better, because that game is all about drafting cards, and you can pick from any of the cards. And it was a huge table talk, because you'd have to lay out all the cards everywhere. Well, now it just took up as much room as the game box, because everything was standing up. And it was easy to see how many were left, what was sold out, wasn't available. That was awesome. So the specific one, and again, I'll try to find a link, that we did manage to get a copy on Etsy, because everyone on BoardGameGeek was like, put this up somewhere we can buy it. And they put it up on Etsy. So that is the specific. Ryan was looking for a specific. That's the specific. But overall, I just got to say good box inserts. Like, good box inserts. Now, the key is good. You can give me a box insert that organizes all the stuff. That's great, especially if it lets me fit expansions in the core game box. I do appreciate that. But what I really want is something that makes gameplay better. The most basic is a way for me to take those trays out and put them on the table so everyone can reach them. Or give me individual trays for every player so I can go, here are the blue parts, here's the yellow parts, here's the red parts. Or whatever else. A little standee that holds up the market cards so they're easier to see by everyone. Whatever it happens to be. There are tons of options for box inserts, but to me, there has to be more than just storage.
Interesting. Yeah, as we were saying this, we think about, a lot of us think about these sort of things being new. You know, board game inserts are new. My copy of The Game of Life from the 1970s had money holders. When you took the lid off, they were actually slotted so you could insert all of the cash money and insurance slots separated and hand them around like that. And I was just realizing, I'm like, wow, this, you know, some of these inserts go back to the 70s and were actually not fan created, but from the actual manufacturer. Now, when I was thinking of things, one of the first things that came to mind, and one of the first things I picked up, was when KeyForge came out big. The initial chits and counters and things you got with the game were pretty meh. Plus, if you didn't want to buy the starter box, you didn't get any chits at all. Yep. So in order to play the game, you really needed them. And Etsy was right there on the job with a ton of fantastic fan-created options, both plastic cut, and I ended up getting some wood cut, painted, colored chits that were just fantastic and are still, to this day, how I want to play if I'm going to break out my KeyForge decks.
KeyForge is doing so well right now that one of our local game stores was giving away the decks for free. If you bought anything else, you got a deck.
Yeah.
But the game is still going strong.
They're still putting out new content for it. I keep hearing about it because I actually signed up to GameForge to keep an eye on it at one point. They won't stop sending me things about it. as anyone who knows who's ever signed up to anything on GameForge, GameFound knows. But again, I never hear about anyone playing it. I never see it being played anywhere. We had some fun for a brief while, but
Fantasy Flight, they got hacked and lost the algorithm. In between, fans kept the game going. So speaking of fan created content, kept the game going for a bit, but then Fantasy Flight has put out a new set. So I don't know if they have a new algorithm, how compatible. I know there's three new factions. I don't know. The game's still around. I'm sure there are people playing out there, but I got to say your components put mine to shame, right? I've got what came in the cardboard box and I feel lesser when playing against you because I'm like, damn, that's really nice. Here's my cardboard token.
When I'm thinking about upgrades that I want to go buy on Etsy, when Box of Quedlinburg, they made the Geek Up bits. So and there's a lot of different variations on those that make the tokens that you're drawing out of the bag just a better experience, right? But then there's also these wee crates to hold all the material components that you're drawing. And that will hold the spell books up at an angle so that you can see them. And those are really clever. So I have had them bookmarked for forever and have not bought them because shipping to Canada sucks.
Yeah, we'll just call it the Board Game Geek Store in general. Like we talked about Etsy quite a bit, has a lot of awesome stuff that, again, was originally created by fans and it's being sold through Board Game Geek. There were some really nice upgrades in the Board Game Geek Store. And I've got to say, those the Quacks of Quedlinburg ones are fantastic. Like, yes, they cost more than the game, which seems a little ridiculous. But like until you played, if you play Quacks a lot, you're going to want them. And yes, I want some form of organizing those in trays that hold up your recipes. So there's a few different companies out there. And I thought they were awesome looking.
It's one of those you put it away in the box, but it also gets it out to the table quicker and in a better state, right? So that's a win-win.
Yep. Yep.
When I'm thinking about setup aids, one of the first things that comes to mind is the Esoteric Order of Gamers. Their rules summary and player reference sheets are top notch. They're well organized. They have great layouts. And having those printouts can help you get playing quicker and then help with rules lookups mid-game. So, and they don't charge for those. So they do ask that people support them on Patreon and stuff. Yep. So that is some very cool free content.
Although I was looking at Esoteric the other day and they have a lot less than I thought. I was surprised. I was expecting more, but there's only like there's under 500 games there throughout their entire history of adding stuff.
Are they 450 some games, I think.
Something like that.
And I mean, you can tell they put a lot of time into each one. So
Now, are they still putting out stuff? Is there stuff for new games, or is that part of the problem? Is they're the site's still up and you can still get the stuff.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to be trying to reference which is new game, which isn't, is tough. Oh, and Eggman Jr. says, yes, they are.
All right. So correction, KeyForge is not back with Fantasy Flight. It's someone else who has put out a new version.
It is all supposed to be compatible, though, I believe.
Yeah, Ghost Galaxy has taken it over. It's weird because I got a newsletter from Fantasy Flight about the new set, which is what confused me. But yes, there are two sets. Since the game was stopped by Fantasy Flight, two sets have been related by Ghost Galaxy.
Eggman Jr. is saying that Esoteric Order of Gamer only does games that appeal to him, which fair. So he just does the games he likes.
Yep. Yeah. There you go. For a perfect example of fan created content for games they love. All right. Next one I'm going to bring out kind of goes with the Geek Up bits. But again, this is going back in time quite a bit to when D&D 4th edition came out. I was looking for a way to track all of the status effects in 4th edition D&D. And eventually there ended up being Wizards of the Coast official versions of all these things. But at the time when the system first came out, everyone was trying to come up with ideas to track things. Like if you're bloodied, if you have a mark, the area effect spells that stayed in play and all of that stuff. And at that time, Facebook, I was still pretty new to, I discovered a company called Litco Aero Systems. Now, this is a company that does laser cut stuff. So birchwood as well as acrylic. And they made stuff for war games, like heavy hex encounter chip war games and miniature war games and micro armor for anyone who knows what micro armor is. And they had little cool like flame tokens and artillery tokens and markers and all this stuff. Well, they put out a D&D 4E set that included some really basic bloodied tokens, which was something else that was important to know in D&D, which was just they were red tokens kind of shaped like a pool. You put them under your miniature, and then eventually they put out a set of marks. So I bought all that stuff off them because at the time I was running Living Forgotten Realms and running public play, and having the extra pizzazz at the table was part of what drew people into the game. Well, I actually reached out to them and helped them design an entire 4E set of stuff. So I came up with different types of marks. I gave them a list of all the various status tokens in D&D, and they picked a different color from each one. And then we worked together to do what we called corner markers, which were just little L-shaped things you would put in the corner of your grid to show what it was. So I actually worked with Litco Aero Systems to come up with D&D 4E markers. And well, from there, it just exploded, right? Like now you can still, people made magnetic things that stacked under your characters and special poker chips. And like there were all kinds of different versions out there. And I noticed now that 5e's out, it tends to be rings with words on them that you put around your miniatures instead of under their bases. But that was so useful for what was a rather complicated tactical combat system with lots of things to track. I remember I actually had a thing I taped on the back of my DM screen that was what each color meant. So, you know, like confused was yellow and paralyzed was purple, so people could easily tell what was going on. And that just made the game flow so much better. There was no questions, right? Who's bloodied? Is he bloodied yet? Who's marked? Am I still marked? Is that spell still affecting this? Does it reach the wall? You know, and all of it was right there on the table.
All right. Well, sticking with RPGs, one of the things I found that was fantastic when I first discovered it is randomizer decks. So I found this from a bunch of different individuals who had published their content on drive-through cards. And they're fantastic. And you can get all sorts from weather randomizers to encounters and more. And these are a great accessory to have at the table in your hands. And something I prefer far more than using, digital randomizers and things like that. Having that physical card in front of you, you know, you pulled it out of the deck, you know that the weather today is cloudy with a chance of rain or whatever it is. You can have that out right in front of you, sitting there, you know, on your DM screen or whatever as a reminder. And you can tap it if it comes into play, if it's actually taking apart. You know, if you're having a thunderstorm later today, you can tap it when that thunderstorm's happening and remind yourself of things going on, or random encounter decks or random creature decks and things like that are just fantastic to have physical editions of. And some of them go all out. There was one deck I picked up that's actually got its weather and locations, and it's all different. There's like seven different things on the card depending on how you turn it and use it. Those are just fantastic.
Yeah, I've loved stuff like that. Going back to AD&D second edition, I ran like a 10-year campaign using the deck of encounters box one and the deck of encounters box two. And that was from TSR. That wasn't fan made, but it was like the same idea, right? And it was divided up by region and weather. And you'd be like, okay, you guys are wandering on the plane, start rolling on a table. I just draw a card, or ahead of time, I could have cards out and stuff like that. The D&D card game, not card game. They did a bunch of collectible cards. I use the same way. And it's great to see fans creating this stuff as well. I got to say, though, I also appreciate the internet once, because there is anything you want. If you run a role playing game in any genre, you can find a random generator online, going from full on world generators that will generate your map and all the factions and all the cities down to all the shops and all the cities. That's actually one of the best I found. To just like a random NPC name list. Like all of that is out there. If you want a random list of something, it's out there on the internet. And I just got to say, like, that's just awesome, because like I grew up not having those tools.
There's actually, I had picked it up a while ago, and I'll have to find a link for Mo. But it's a DM's toolkit where it stores randomizers. So you can actually add your own randomizers, and it's your randomizers in one place. And you can, you know, pick from templates or build your own custom. And it's one, it was one sort of a suite of tools, but one of the tools in that suite was this collection of randomizers.
That's clever.
Next, I'm going to call it custom dice. In particular, I have the old Games Workshop Hero Quest. No, you can't quite see it in the camera. It's above my head. And I have the French version with the henchmen you can hire. And one of the problems with that old Hero Quest game is it had wooden dice that were, I assume, silkscreened. I assume we were doing silkscreening. If not, whatever, painted dice that weren't etched. And over time, those dice wore out. Even more so was HeroScape. For some reason, whoever printed the HeroScape dice were absolutely terrible for the dice wiping off. So at some point, I think I got them through an RPG Geek thread where I just contacted someone that made them. I got a set of custom HeroQuest dice, and they're fantastic. They were etched, and they're not going to fall apart. Now, of course, the new printing of HeroQuest comes with better dice that aren't going to have that problem, but I thought that was awesome. There are tons of custom dice out there for various games, whether it's just simple enough of replacing the symbol on the six with whatever. Heck, I've got dice from like the Misdirected Mark podcast, where the six is the Misdirected Mark symbol. I just think that's cool. It's a cool fan thing, a way to upgrade your dice. Then there's the funky dice from, I'm drawing a blank on the company right now, and I apologize. The DCC dice. I can't remember who makes them off the top of my head right now, which is bad. With the funky dice sizes that actually work with the game. And then there's the hero dice, the poly hero dice from Tabletop Tycoon, which is going to come up later in the show. I love custom dice. Like every gamer, I think, likes dice. And now custom dice are everywhere. Another example is Gaslands. So Gaslands actually falls under two categories here, because Gaslands is Osprey Games, and Osprey is very good for publishing a rule book that you should be able to use your existing stuff with. And Gaslands is a post-apocalyptic Car Wars style game where you use Hot Wheels. Well, to play it, you need these templates and you need D6 dice, and preferably custom D6 dice. I don't think the book was even published yet before people on Etsy already had custom templates and dice you can buy. And I got to say, it's just awesome. Like the game I played with Dave Garby printed his own copies, because there's also STL files out there. And the game's just better, right? I don't have to remember a four means this, and I don't have to use a paper template to move my cars.
Now, I mentioned earlier when I was first talking about this, a little bit of annoyance about quality. But that's not to say that all fan-made stuff can't be high quality. For instance, DC deck building fans have created a unified game manual. Mm. This takes all the rules from far too many expansions, some people might say, and puts them into one concise book, rather than having 8 or 10 or 12 different books stacked on top of your universe, you know, your big box of collecting all the stuff. Now, to be fair, they have gotten into some copyright infringement issues in the art that they have used to make it look as professional as it does, but they have gone to a lot of effort, done amazing layout work, and it is, aside from the questionable artwork, a fantastic resource for fans of the game like me who have all these pieces and struggle with all the different rule books.
Now, that's super cool. I could think of a few more games that could use a consolidated rule book like that.
Yeah, I'm also reminded of the Blood Bowl Living rulebook that I think is now maintained by Games Workshop, but for years was maintained by the fans who just kept adding in new new teams and new star players and updating the rules as things went on. And I think that's a fantastic resource. Now, here's an interesting one that is one of my favorite. And if I had had more time today, I would have tried to dig it out, because I know it's in one of my comic book boxes somewhere. And that is fan-made content that came from an issue of Protoculture Addicts, for anyone who's our age and is an old anime fan. This was an anime fanzine. And what it had was stats for the Robotech Macross characters for the Artelsorian game Teenagers from Outer Space. And that is awesome, because the entire magazine was just a fanzine, right? It was all just people writing in about the anime they loved, maybe getting an article or two in there, and maybe an official announcement from one of the people, but mostly it was grassroots people who were probably bootlegging the anime at the time. And I love the fact that in that one, like, I'll never forget that Minmay had the skill wrap boys around Littlefinger at level 6, which was the highest level you could have in a skill in that game.
I'm just wondering if that isn't available online now somewhere.
Oh, probably.
Yeah.
I've never looked around for it. I don't remember the issue number, but I bet you if you just Google Macross stats, Big Trouble, or not Big Trouble, but Teenagers from Outer Space, you could probably find it.
More than likely. So one of the most universally useful, if not always the highest quality, is solo solutions for multiplayer games. Mm. Now, your mileage really varies on these. But if you've got a game that you can never get people to play, that doesn't have, there's probably a variant out there, if not an official solo variant. The fan-made ones are everywhere, and there are plenty of them in all of the file sections for so many games on Board Game Geek, especially now post-pandemic, where mm-hmm. everyone was trying to find ways to play every game in their collection, whether they could get together with people or not. Again, your mileage may vary, as usually they are created by a single fan who has their specific goal in mind. But especially if you can find the ones that are made by an amalgam of different fans who've worked together, you've got some great options there. And a lot of these, you know, each game will have 3, 4, 5 or more different solo games. So mm-hmm. pick the one that works best for you.
Yeah, it's not just solo rules. There were also a bunch of ways to hack games to make them playable online or via Zoom that came out during the pandemic, mm-hmm. both official and unofficial. So it was an interesting trend to follow.
Yeah, the one I'm trying, there is one designer. I'm trying to find the name. No, that's not the one I recognize. I remember for a while there, it was like every Kickstarter would come out or every new game would publish and we're like, with solo rules, bye. Mm-hmm. And it was the one who came up with the term Atoma. And now everyone tends to use that term Atoma for their games. And that was like the name of the AI player in the first game this person worked on. I apologize. I tried to Google it while you were talking and I can't find exactly who it was. But I remember one particular game designer like specialized in making solo rules for games so much so that multiple publishers then use them on their future games, which was pretty cool.
I do remember that. And I can't remember their name.
Yeah, at least a quick Tusky. Google failed me here. So I wasn't able to find
Tusky.
It.
Tusky?
Well, I'll have to figure out later if that's actually who you're talking about.
Maybe.
I think Eggman might be right.
That might be it. David Zerke, it could be that may be the right one. It's not the one who did the Scythe Atoma, which is where I thought it came from. I'm looking, that was Morten Monrad Pedersen.
No, that's not it.
And I don't think that's the name I remember. So anyway, next. We reviewed Endangered last week, right? So I'm going to consider this one an honorable mention because I haven't tried it myself. But while doing some research for the episode and noting online that there is a ton of fan-created content. Now, a ton doesn't mean 50, 60 different animals, but there's a surprising amount for what's fairly new game that's fairly niche that is still kind of a hidden gem, and we hope to change that. Go play Endangered. It's awesome. Fantastic cooperative game. These include the ones I was able to find quickly were the River Pearl Mussel, which I've got to say, you've got to be a fan to create a scenario about an endangered species of mussels. Whales, which just makes sense, right? I personally want to play that one wearing Star Trek cosplay. Scenario cards for species in the first expansion. So I guess the expansion box doesn't actually have like the foldable species cards that come in the base game. So someone made some. I just think it's really cool. And it's just an example of one of many, many games that have this kind of thing. But just the number of fan-created stuff for Endangered and other games like it.
Another one that comes up, and again, this is came to me related to that DC deck building game, but card lists. These can be a lifesaver if you're rearranging a game or pulling out or sorting at certain expansions. It's something that every publisher should be producing, and some do, but others don't. And that's where the fans come in and rescue you from tearing your hair out, trying to check every little card for some little symbol somewhere on it that mentions that it may or may not be part of this or that expansion.
Oh, heck yes. Trying to sort an expansion out from a game can be hell. And a good component list can be a lifesaver. Like those card lists or the component lists that people bother to put together and put up on BoardGameGeek and stuff, those are super helpful.
Yeah, not only just for pulling out expansions, just like if I'm trying to sell a bunch of my games to know they're complete, or if I go to buy a game, like there's just lots of reasons. There should be a full component list. Honestly, this one's to me unforgivable from the publishers. I'm going to toss one on there that I feel is just as important, and that is a setup sheet. No one does this, but thank you, fans, because lots of fans out there have done one-page or two-page setup sheets for board games. That is something else I still don't understand why more publishers don't include. Like, it can't cost that much more to put one extra sheet of paper in there. Give me a sheet that tells me how to set up the game quickly so when I bring it to Walkerville Brewery, for one, people can take the game to the table themselves and get it set up because it's nice and simple, and for two, I can get it set up nice and simple. Next one I've got is digital map-making tools. There are enough of these out there. This is more of a TTRPG thing, but you can also use them for some board games, definitely for war games and miniature games. We did an entire episode on this. So, and I've got an episode on the blog also. So these are just fantastic. Like, they range from professional tools that mappers use, like that work for companies that Paizo and Wizards of the Coast use, stuff like Campaign Cartographer, to really simple drag and drop tools. And there was one that just basically gave you a gray thing and you used your mouse to draw the maze. Like, that was it. For more info on these, check out our 19 great free or low cost digital map making tools for tabletop gamers article, or find a list on our X Marks the Spot, which is episode 147 of our podcast, which will be better than the one we shared earlier on our podcast because it's 140 episodes later.
We shouldn't be sharing anything that's numbered under 50. I'm scared.
Yeah, that's 17, I think it was. Yes. We shared earlier. I didn't go check it. I didn't go listen to it. I didn't want to be scared.
So while I talked about how I love physical randomizers, and I really do, a deck of cards can really go a long way, but sometimes you don't need or want that. And a perfect example is when you have all the expansions, but you can only use so many in each game. Games like Card Kingdoms or Dominion or DC Deck Builder even. In these cases, the physical randomizers are often more trouble than they're worth. So fans have created actual apps, and not like computer apps, but phone apps for Android, especially because you still can't cross load much onto Apple, but where you can, with a simple tap, get the list of cards that you're going to put out on the table all ready to go without having to worry about shuffling a deck and drawing random things and deciding, oh, I don't actually like that expansion. So you can just set it in your app and hit the button. Good. You're good to go.
Another digital tool I like, or physical, actually goes both ways, is custom score sheets. I would donate Geek Gold to whoever created these on Board Game Geek, because they can be very useful. Many games don't come with score pads, but they should. The Terraforming Mars was one of the big ones, where there are so many different things you're scoring in that game. And I get it, you could just slowly move your token up the track, but it's so much easier to use them. Now, I used to print these off and I'd put them in my game boxes, especially if we're going to host a public play event or run like a Board Game Blitz tournament, especially the tournament, because we want everyone to make sure they get their scores right. Now, hats off to the people creating them. But now what I find even better is the Board Game Stats app has a built-in score sheet for every game. Now, there's a generic one where it just lists three lines, so you can break up three things, and every game has that, which is nice. But hats off and thanks to everyone who is making official full score sheets on the Board Game app. This is now my preferred way to add up points at the end of the game. And I'll leave the ones that came in the game in the box, because these often are better.
Oh, I still like Dead Trees, and I appreciate printable custom score sheets.
Next, I'm just going to call out, since I just mentioned the Board Game Stats app. Sean got it way before I did. It took me a few years before I actually picked it up, but I got to say, hats off to the Board Game Stats app. It's not free, and there's a premium version, which I do not pay for at this point, but it is a really great tool for anyone who tracks their plays and wants to know how often they play games, their win-loss ratio, even interesting stuff like, what are the most played games last month? What are the highest played by most different people? What are the games played the most plays logged, even if it's the same person? Looking at what you played the last month, there's just all kinds of cool stuff in there. Plus score sheets, which the score sheet thing amused me because Sean had the app for a long time without realizing they were even in there. So, and I'm sure there's features I don't know are in there.
Yeah, it's a fantastic app. I've been singing its praises for quite some time, even without apparently knowing all of its functions. And I'm happy to pay for it because, the benefits we get out of it are great. So I started pretty early on giving them money just because they absolutely earned it.
And it's not a subscription service. You just buy the app and you've got it. I think the premium might be.
Well, you can get, if you want cloud services, you got to pay extra.
I knew that they advertise now and then asking me for more money. And I'm like, I've never felt the need for it. All right. Speaking of apps, I'm going to call out one that I have no idea if it actually fits Ryan's question, because I don't even know if the person who played it has ever played a board game in their life. But Schwazi, C-W-A-Z-I. This is an app for choosing teams and choosing people to go first. I don't even know why it was originally developed, but this is the best start player you'll ever find. It's objective. Everyone puts their finger on the phone and it picks. There's even more tools. Like, I don't know how many people deep dive this, but you can set up teams at a time. You can have it pick which player color you play. It is great for making random choices at the start of a game.
All right. And I'm going to put in an honorable mention here because this is a game I've never actually played, but I think it sort of goes to the core of Ryan's question. And it even got a little mention earlier on in the chat room, and that is Android Netrunner. This game was killed off by its publisher, and their fan base took over the game and has kept the game running for I don't even know how many years now. There is a nonprofit organization now that is just the fans of this game who are hosting and sponsoring conventions because they love their game.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Didn't something similar happen with Vampire the Eternal Struggle? Yep. I feel like that might be a pretty common thing for CCGs.
Yeah, I don't know if Vampire's still going, but it was for years. A game we talked about last week, Dragon Dice. SFR Games is not like some huge publishing company with lots of games under the belt. That's some fans that really love Dragon Dice that, again, like Netrunner, not only took over the game and got the original license, but are putting out new content for it regularly. I don't know if Dragon Dice is big enough anywhere to run tournaments right now. I don't think it was ever as big as Netrunner, but that's another example of a game people kept going. And then Keyforge, which we mentioned earlier. Again, it's being run by fans. 7C, the Star Trek trading card game, the Decipher one, Deanna and I used to love. That was our favorite CCG back in the day. It's still being kept alive for fans. And I wouldn't be surprised if we searched Middle Earth the Wizards and there wasn't some fan out there still publishing cards for that game.
So there are some of our favorite fan-made additions to games that we love. And now it's time to check in with the cardboard connoisseurs in our chat room here on Twitch. What do you guys have for us?
There has been a ton of chat in the Twitch here. This is fantastic. Thanks, everyone, for jumping in. I guess everyone sort of mentions Esoteric Order first and foremost. Those just really, everyone sort of knows them. And we've mentioned them many, many a time on the show as well. Everdell Component Holders, which started on Etsy, but actually became an official partnership after the fact.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, I think, where publishers are like, wait a minute. I know one of the attitudes out there is the publisher like, oh, third party people are making money off our game. We're gonna sneak in and do it ourselves. And I don't think that's the attitude. I think the attitude is these are awesome flipping components that people are going to enjoy our game more with. So we're going to publish them too.
I guess the slotted overlays have resulted in a number of publishers creating official versions or double layer boards like Terraforming Mars did after the fact. And Ryan's mentioning they enjoy creating their own from scratch, no glue foam core inserts. And there's a lot of guides to that in a lot of different Board Game Geek areas. You can get here's if you want a guide to how I made my insert with no glue and foam core. You know, it's right there on a lot of them.
I'm going to call out one that we didn't talk about, which was family-friendly versions of games. Mm-hmm. My Little Scythe started off as a fan-made. The there was Battlestar Galactica, what do they call it? Express? Yeah, BSG Express was then later published as Dark Moon. There's one more that happened recently. Roger Dodger's calling out the Prometheus mod for Abomination Heir to Frankenstein, which is a shorter and faster version of the game.
The DM toolkit I was looking for seems to have actually faded. I could not find it, so that it may be gone. And unfortunately, I uninstalled that some time ago because I just wasn't putting the effort into it needed.
So Ryan calls out metal coins, which I think are great upgrades. Yet again, not fan created, but I am going to have to call out the Iron Clays as a fantastic. Here's one I thought of, Bennies, for the role-playing games that you...
Oh, there are so many cool Bennies out there.
Yes, Bennies for
STL files and cool things you can buy.
Card inventories are great for Ryan in his adaptation work. That's very, very important. You need to know what's there if you're going to be adapting it for any purpose.
People are agreeing that Ark Nova's fan-made solo mode is considered superior to the official solo mode.
There you go. Oh, another one I used to love doing when I ran role-playing games is custom character sheets. Because I've never loved the character sheets that came with any game except for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. That sheet I've yet to see anyone improve on, but like every D&D sheet that TSR up to WotC has ever published, I've always found better fan-made sheets out there.
Well, character keepers, especially, anyone nowadays who plays any Powered by the Apocalypse games or any games like that know the value of Google Sheets and character keepers and the power you get in some of those. I know the character keeper I've used for Masks has the entire set of character information. So you just choose, you know, what role you're in, and it pre-fills almost everything for you and manages, you know, when you click on this, it adjusts that. They're very programmatic, all just done by fans in Google Sheets. All right. Well, I think we're getting to the end of that right now.
Thank you, as always, you awesome chat room, for all of your suggestions and adding to the conversation. Always appreciated.
All right. Well, and now a word from our sponsor, Grand Gamers Guild.
The Booba Kiki and Stroop Reprint Kickstarter is live right now.
Both of these games come from the mind of John Schaefer, whose fans of the show should recognize as the designer of the Holiday Hijinks series of games.
Booba Kiki uses a real-world psychological concept to facilitate gameplay. Let's say I ask you, what does a booba look like? Okay, what about a kiki? The world over, 90% of people say that a booba is a rounded shape and that a kiki is a spiky shape, regardless of language or culture.
Booba Kiki takes the hive mind mechanic of Just One and the storytelling scenarios of the crew and mashes them into a fun communication party game featuring six mini campaigns of ever-increasing difficulty.
Also included in this Kickstarter is a third printing of Stroop, which is also based on a psychological effect, the delay in reaction time caused by conflicting input. For example, cards with names of colors that aren't in the same colors as the name.
Stroop is a card-shedding game played over two rounds. In round one, the word on the table must describe the card in your hand. Once you get used to that, in round two, the card on the table must be described by the word in your hand.
Pledge $20 US for a copy of Booba Kiki Deluxe with RID tokens and all unlocked stretch goals. Or for $36, you top it in a copy of Stroop Deluxe. Again, these deluxe editions will not be sold in stores unless stores actually back the Kickstarter.
And while this won't help you out on the Kickstarter, if you ever end up shopping over on the Grand Gamers Guild webpage, you can save 10% by using our special code BELLHOP, BELLHOP.
Well, that's it for our talk about our favorite fan-made gaming accessories and add-ons. What is some fan-created content you love? We'd love to hear about it, with links if you can in the comments below.
Or better yet, jump on the Tabletop Bellhop Discord at discord.tabletopbellhop.com and start up a conversation there.
One quick announcement before moving on to talking about games we've been playing.
We've got merch!
Yes, it's true. The official Tabletop Bellhop merch store is finally live. You can find it at tabletopbellhop.com/merch.
We've got...
M-E-R-C-H.
We've got mugs. Yes, mugs. Nice, big, 15-ounce Tabletop Bellhop gaming podcast mugs. We've got t-shirts, including the newly added Yellow Pieces Are Mine shirts, even some Bellhop golf shirts.
We also have the first of what I hope will be many board game-inspired t-shirts featuring artwork from our Dotto Gwendolyn. Her first shirt is inspired by a certain game about cats jumping on a bed.
For a limited time, if you buy any two items and use the code TABLETOP, you'll get free shipping up to a $25 value anywhere in the U.S. and Canada.
Now it's time for the Bellhop's Tabletop, where we talk about the games we've been playing lately.
All right, so first ones for this week actually happen at Clark's birthday. That is Kat and Tori, sometimes known as K-Tor, the couple we used to live stream Gloomhaven with and game with regularly. Their son is now 1 year old, and we went to the One Birthday to Rule Them All out in Amherstburg. As usual, because it's Kat and Tori, there were games out on the table, which is awesome. Plus, we brought some games. The game we played the most was Matches. This was our first time playing with our two kids. Didn't rope any strangers in, but the four of us played a couple rounds of Matches. This is the one from our friend Danny from Everyday Board Games. It is still good. I still don't quite know what to call it. The kids both picked it up pretty quickly. It's pretty easy to teach. It's not easy, but it's definitely easier than some. And I still say, if you like traditional card games, just in general, if you like the Hoyle style games, you're probably going to dig Matches.
Yeah, I'm digging Matches. I really think the only place that this game is failing is we've yet to come up with a quick, simple way to explain it to folks. So yeah. Kat came over and asked what are you guys playing? And you just like went off into this lengthy 10-minute explanation. I saw her eyes glaze over and I'm like, I want to just be able to say, well, it's like this. It's a trick taker. But it's not. It's you do matching pairs, but you don't. I don't know what to call it or what kind of game it is, really.
Yeah, because even Kat said that. She's like, so is it trick taking? We're like, no, not really. So is it hand shedding? Sort of. That's part of it. Now we're jumping out of order here, but I figure this way, why not just talk about the game together? So we played this there twice. Kids liked it. Everyone seemed to enjoy it. People were intrigued. Kat and Tori wanted to try it, but they were busy, you know, being social, talking to all the people there for their son's birthday. But we also broke this one out at the barbershop bar where we hosted a game night last weekend, and we played a couple more rounds. Now, Sean got to try this one, so we'll get his thoughts in a second. And this is actually the first time we tried the burn cards. So in addition to being a Hoyle-style card game, there is a gamer element they threw in. Danny threw in a take that element of the game where there's a card market where you can buy cards or points that do nasty things to the other players. Now, the key here is the fact they cost you your points. So it's kind of a difficult decision. I don't know on these. Like, I like them. I thought they were interesting. I like that they're an option. But I don't know if I would always want them. I definitely wouldn't always want them in. Personally, I think they'd be good for a New Year's Eve, or if adult beverages are involved, or if you're playing a bunch of take that games like Cash and Guns and stuff all that night, then I'd throw them in there.
Yeah, unfortunately, due to it being at the barbershop bar, we had some visibility lighting problems, as is often the case there. And the dark cards meant they did not get used as much as possible because people just didn't necessarily know what they were there when we read them out every round. But you had to remember or you had to ask. And it just became more of a hassle than it was worth when we played the game without the burn cards first and knew the game. Mm-hmm. Like, we could all play the game conveniently, and it was nice and easy. So adding the burn cards was sort of one of those, I'm not going to worry about asking everyone what they are every time. I'm just going to go ahead and play. It's really still out on whether or not they're useful or not, because they just didn't get enough use in the dark.
I haven't tried the burn cards yet, so verdict is out.
Now, Sean, that was your first time ever playing matches. What'd you think of matches?
It's a solid game. No, it's really easy to pick up. And it flows nicely. Again, I don't know how to describe it, but if you know how to play card games, you're going to have a good time with it, I think.
Now, at the same event, we're at the birthday party. There were some other games on our table, and I grabbed one because the kids were with us, and our kids are obsessed with cats, as is any generation raised on the internet, I think. And well, cats are awesome. It is called Kitten. And it's a stacking game in a tin, which makes the name Kitten a bit of a pun, right? That's the joke there. This was a Kickstarter that KTOR backed that showed up. It had some Kickstarter promo cards in it. And I got to say, it was really cool. So inside it were six different colored and shaped cats, and they're fairly small. The yellow cat really looked like a Flintstone vitamin to me, like, you know, the carved vitamins, and they were wood, but like they kind of looked like you wanted to eat them. And they were in like the yellow was just a straight cat. Another one was like kind of an H shape, and one was an L shape. And it's one of these stacking dexterity games. And there are a number out like this where you flip a card. Everyone then starts to real time try to stack up the cats to match the card. First one who's done says meow. Then you check to see if it's right. And if it's right, they keep the card. Otherwise, everyone keeps building until someone gets it right. And you play to three cards. Now, it was fun. It was exactly what I expect. Mackie Stack is a similar game. There was the one with the test tubes. Dr. Eureka kind of has that same thing going. It's definitely a genre of game that's out there. And I got to say, it's a solid one. The tin was nice and small, which is good. Nice and portable. Easily throw it in a pocket or a purse, which is cool. My daughter Genevieve loved it because, well, it was stacking cats. We had fun with it. It was a neat game.
I sought out on Kittens. Real-time race to complete is not my jam, but the kids did look like they were having a blast. And I know Mo was saying we should probably get a copy for our public play events, which I could see people digging it.
Yeah, I can definitely see this probably isn't my thing, but it certainly is going to be a lot of people's thing. It's a good, good kind of party event.
Next up, we did have a barbershop name night, which we noted already. Started off the event. We got there a little early, ordered some food. Walking Tacos were back. I can't guarantee they'll be back next month, but they're at least back this month. I know some people were disappointed they weren't there last week. Started off by showing Sean Pirate Tales. We played a three-player game with Gwen, which I think went pretty well. Lighting is so nice when you can sit in the window. Then we finished, and people were kind of watching us play, so we grabbed a couple of those people and played a full six-player game, which I was glad to get to try the game with six, with more players. Now, we talked about this one last week, Deanna and I. This is the game where you're drawing three cards and you keep one, you bury one face up and you bury one face down. So first time you played, what'd you think, Sean?
You know, as I said on the night of, there's a feel graphically like Point Salad to me. I know Dee had been talking about it feeling a little childish graphically, and to me, it felt Point Salad-y, aside from the image on the front of the box, which is definitely childish. But no, I wouldn't say they're comparable as a game, but it's a fun, light game, and you can play it with or without that deep card counting and strategy. And I found that feeling was the same I got from Point Salad, right? You can keep do all the card counting and keep track of things in either game, but you can also just, you know, throw some nuts down on the table and go to it.
I think what it was is it's just the tiny box with that art on it, and Mo pulls it out and it's just a deck of cards, and there's some, and he puts the things in the middle with some big X marks of spots, and I thought, oh, we're going to play a kid's game. Cool. I'm waiting to see.
Yeah, I don't know. I like this one. I think that I've learned that I made a mistake in describing the game. What I want a fan created rule summary or something I can put on the table that is very clear about how you score your cards, because that is the catch, that's the hitch that everyone gets stuck on. Is one card you score nothing, two you score your lowest, three you score your middle, four you score your highest. No matter how many times I repeat it, no matter how many times we say it, people miss it. The first round Sean and I played, he totally missed it and collected like eight of one card, which I'm like, well, that's impressive that you were able to remember where enough peanuts were, say. But having more than four is not really worth it unless you're picking up that 8 or 12.
Right.
Now, we already talked about our play of matches, so we're going to skip ahead to a four-player game of Holotype Mesozoic North America. This went over really well, but I got to say the game was longer than I remembered. Like, it still had the quick flow. One of the things I love about that game is there is very little downtime between turns. But the overall game took longer than I actually thought it was going to take. It was good to see in this one, people claimed global objectives where they had all the elements. So it wasn't just a matter of people spending research to grab them. So that was cool. I hadn't seen that often. Everyone seemed to really dig it, went over well with the crowd. And this was my first experience playing this one in public with not strangers. They're local gamers, I know, but not my family. So that was good to see it went over well. And we're going to have more to say about that one in a bit, because that is one of our featured reviews tonight.
So while the Holotype was playing, I got in a game of Aqualyn with Gwen. And, well, she crushed me completely. I admit it was my first play of the game, but she's darn good at it. I've got no excuses. It was her first time playing with the correct rules, however. It did not slow her down. So that was a 20-point deficit for me on that one. So
wait, so are you saying I taught my kid to play the game Extreme? No, that would never happen.
Yeah, I still remember as we were doing the review up, we realized that it had been being played wrong the whole time.
Yeah, to the fact that I then went and played it by the proper rules before publishing the review, just so I can make sure. I still think it's better the other way. I think it's better where your creature slides until it has to stop, right? Like the ice puzzle, the block puzzles you find in various JRPGs. But no, that's not the rules. You can slide the piece any number of squares. One of the things we plan on doing on our Instagram is sharing some of these extreme plays so that other people can learn from our mistakes. And I bet you there's people out there going, yeah, I played it that way too. So that's one we have to record, I think, is we're going to have to do an Aqualyn one. Finished off Barbershop Bar with a quick game of Gelatinous because it was like 9:45. And while the event's till 10 and I don't like leaving before 10, even though I knew no other games were going to start off. The only part that amused me about this, I'm going to call out, and I'm sorry, Gwen, if you're listening and embarrassed by this, but she's like, oh, I like this game. I'm good at it. I'm like, okay, sure. I'm glad your Gelatinous strategy took the night. Good job there rolling those dice. Because that is, you know, people like to argue if game, you know, the mind, is it a game or is it an experience? Well, Gelatinous is an experience.
Gelatinous is an exercise in rolling dice. There is no skill involved.
Yeah.
The child is good at games, but the fact that she thinks she's good at that one makes me rethink all the strategy.
I was absolutely horrible at that game. I could not roll a 3 to save my life. But
we'll see. You need to learn from Gwen. Maybe she can give you some tips.
Need to learn. Up next, he and I, kind of a date night thing we did. We went to a local high-end place that does craft beers. Great place. If you're in Windsor, check it out. I'm drawing a complete blank on the name right now. Erie Street Gastropub. There it is. But that's not the important part here. The important part here is we tried out Vinyl Jukebox. So the first thing, I learned this during the unboxing video, but to reiterate it here for anyone looking at vinyl or the various vinyl games, think of vinyl like Valeria. It is a bunch of separate standalone games about collecting albums. They are not related to each other. They are not tied together. They just have the common theme of collecting albums, 45s in particular. This particular one, Jukebox, is a two-player only version. And again, it's not a two-player only version of vinyl. It's just the two-player game in the vinyl series of games. I had a cool theme. You had a jukebox, and you had a very physical jukebox that you set up in front of you. And you had you have a bag full of coins that are silver, like coins that you'd put in a jukebox. And what it was a bag builder. You would pull out coins, and you would put them on, like, not the coin slot, but like, you know how you line up coins on the machine to go next, kind of like that. And you kept pulling them, and then eventually you could spend sets of coins to buy albums that then went on the display at the top of the jukebox. And then once you collected a full row or column of them, you then grab scoring tokens that would go over the part of the jukebox that where they have the list of songs. And I got to say, like, thematically and everything looked really cool here. Your goals were to try to collect sets, right? You had an end game scoring card, and you were trying to get whatever, sets of songs from the 40s or sets of pop songs or sets of country songs and so on. Game looked really cool, but the biggest problem was it was big. These jukeboxes aren't small, and the LPs are big, which makes sense because the LPs need to be big to be able to see them easily across the table. But then, like, you had to have all the scoring tokens out and available, and on top of those tokens were what they called rival coins. And then there's the two bags full of stuff, and just, you couldn't even fit, like, they don't have small tables there, but, like, they're smaller tables. We couldn't set our two jukeboxes facing each other. We had to be offset just to get them to fit.
And I don't see how it could have been smaller, really, because the individual components, like, if the coins had gotten any smaller, they were already fiddly enough. And the vinyls needed to be big enough to be able to see the icons from across the table, right? So, I don't know. It took up too much space for the style of game it was. Like, for a quickish, sort of light two-player game, I don't expect it to be such a table hog. And also, the setup was fiddly. And I know it was our first time playing it, but I feel like anytime you sit down and play that game, you're looking at least 10, 15 minutes of sorting and randomizing and setting out the. And again, it felt like too much for a short, kind of light game, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what you're saying with the whole Valeria thing, it's like Jukebox, the two-player jukebox game set in the universe of vinyl.
Yes, really, it is. That's kind of what it is. And I didn't understand this till other. Now, another thing I found amusing, the unboxing is not live. I don't know when it'll go up. But while doing the unboxing, I was like, hey, they gave us a bonus bag. I don't think they did. While it's not listed on the components, there's a thing at the beginning with the scoring tiles. There's three scoring tiles for every possible combination. You only use two every game. So I think they gave you the bag to put them in and pull them out, because that's what we used it for. But honestly, what it has is otherwise you're shuffling three double-sided with the same thing on both side tiles. And that's just not a good way to randomize anything.
They should not have been double-sided. If they had just made the reverses blank, it would have been so much easier to randomize them. Like, it's just such a goofy thing.
Yeah. Now, as for the gameplay, I don't know. I don't want to say much about this. I don't want to be too harsh on it. It was the end of a long night. It had been a very long day. I wasn't really in the right mood. Well, Erie Street Gas for a Pub is nice. And what would you call it? Aromatic's not the right word. Wow, my brain is not
working. Atmospheric?
Tonight. Atmospheric. There you go. Atmospheric, a great place to sit by candlelight and sip some craft beers, is not great for playing games. And for whatever reason, the game just wasn't doing it for me. I was having a hard time with the rules. I usually don't have a problem with rules sticking in my head. And I read the book multiple times, and I just was finding, like, little rules were hidden in weird places. And I'm like, wait, what? I can't remember an example. Like, what do you do with a rival token? And I just couldn't find it.
Yeah, I have never had Mo hand me the rule book over to look at so often when learning a new game. I will say that the rule book made perfect sense to me, but then I don't tend to read rule books much at all because I just let Mo do all the work and teach me. So I think maybe because I didn't have any expectations on how it should be laid out, I was able to find all the information, whereas he was expecting it to be laid out in a certain fashion and was going, oh, it's not here. Why is it not here?
Yeah, one of the things that got me is where you would put examples, like off to the right in a sidebar were key rules. So, like, you'd have all your rules for drawing a coin over here and here. And then over there in the corner would say, like, at the end of the round, do this very important thing. And I wasn't looking there. I was looking in the main column of that. At this point, we owe the game another chance. As far as I'm concerned, when we're both wide awake and well caffeinated and in a nice bright light, and then we'll take another look at Vinyl Jukebox.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to give it another shot. Right now, my feeling on this one is meh.
It's interesting. I do see comments on the listing about the rule book. So you may not be alone on that. Yeah. It's interesting, though. It's listed as a 20 to 30 minute game, and you guys are saying it's a 10 minute setup. That's excessive intro for reward relative. I struggle with that.
Yeah, I don't. How many are there? So there's like 7 tokens you have to randomize. And like we were using the bag, so you're pulling them out. And you're going, okay, I already have one of that one. Or no, I have one. Now I have 2. Okay, good. Then you have to put a special token on top. So you have to find that one specific token that matches that scoring category. Put that on top. And then you draw out again. You're like, oh, I already have 2 of that one. Put that one aside. And then eventually you end up with this grid of all the scoring tiles and 2 for each type with a coin on top, a gold coin, which is a rival coin. So you have to do that. Then you have to mix up all the LPs, which isn't that bad. And then lay out a grid of 9 of those in the market. Then there's building the board. But the big thing was those scoring tiles. Like we had to set a timer to see how quick you could set it up, but it wasn't quick.
You randomized those other coins too. I don't remember what they were called. The silver ones? Because you have
those
to
weren't randomized.
You have to, those weren't random. You just have to lay them out in a grid.
You just have to lay them out, but then you want to lay them out away so they're like grouped by era and then grouped by genre. So it's not just you could just make a pile, but then when you're playing, you're going to have to sort through them all.
Yeah, I'll time it next time. 7 minutes.
It wasn't quick. And even if you played twice in a row, you'd have to re-randomize those, right? Mm-hmm. Like the bonus coins would stay open. The scoring tiles, you'd have to re-randomize. You'd have to shuffle everything again. So it's not even like, it's a quick game and you set it up and it takes a while, but you play 3 rounds. And in between every round, you got to go through all that setup again. Last play for the week, 4-player game of Artemis Project with Sean, Dier, and Brenda. Included the Satellite and Commanders expansion, but we're going to be reviewing that later. So I'm not going to say too much about it now. I just like the expansion, takes a game I like, and makes it a bit better without messing with things too much.
Yeah, my first time trying the expansion, and I can't see any reason I would, turn it away from playing it again.
Yeah, and I still love this game so much. I'd play Artemis Project anytime.
Collect fossils, conduct research, and publish your findings in Holotype, Mesozoic North America, a fast-paced worker placement paleontology game from Brex Works Games, who we have to thank for providing us with a review copy of the game.
So Holotype, I'm just going to call it Holotype for pretty much most of this review, comes from the design team of Brett Harrison and Lex Trenchin, and is the first game published by their own company, Brex Works Games. Originally published through Kickstarter, funding back in 2022 and getting to backers in 2023. Actually, I had some just getting copies now. I saw someone today announcing they got their copy. You should be able to find this one at your friendly local game stores and most online game stores now.
Holotype, which we're just going to call Holotype going forward, yeah, plays 2 to 5 players with games taking an hour or two, which is very dependent on the player count. Well, Brexwork has this one listed as ages 14 plus. We think a younger audience will also dig it, especially because of the dinosaur theme. While it has some meat on it, it's still on the lighter side of worker placement euros, and there are optional rules to make the game even more kid and family friendly. I definitely think this one is good for younger kids.
So in Holotype, players control a team of researchers, which start off as just a paleontologist and their assistant. They're going to use these workers to collect fossils, search for specimens, do research, work with museums, and eventually publish papers, holotypes, on various Mesozoic-era dinosaurs and marine reptiles. After publishing 3 papers, they will attract a grad student, and players will score additional points for completing personal and global objectives.
For a look at the very striking dino artwork and very functional components in this educational game, check out our Holotype unboxing video on YouTube.
The artwork here really is great, as is the card design, the board layout, and the iconography. The custom fossil dice are very well made, and everything in the game is in colorblind friendly colors. While the overall look may not be as shiny and polished as some modern games, they are very functional, everything just works, and the game also includes a very functional plastic box insert.
So you start Holotype by finding the boards that match your player count, shuffling up all the different decks of cards, and putting them beside the main board. You're going to place the Triceratops marker at the start of the field advancement track. Draw and lay out global objectives equal to the player count minus 1. Everyone grabs a player board of their chosen color and gets an initial hand of 3 specimen cards and 2 personal objectives. They're going to choose one of these objectives to keep.
Players start the game with two workers, the paleontologist and assistant. Once a player publishes their third paper, they get the grad student. Each turn, players will place either a single worker out on the board and complete the action for that spot, or collect all of their workers off the board, which earns them one research cube. There are a limited number of spots on a board, and a worker can bump a worker of the same level or lower.
In addition, assistants aren't as powerful as the other workers, and they get you less when they're placed. Assistants also can't publish papers.
Now, there's only actually five different spots you can choose when playing holotype, and they're all pretty simple to resolve. You go to the specimen lab to get new specimen cards. You can either draw from the deck or from the discard pile.
You go on field expositions to get fossils by drawing cards, picking one site to visit, and then rolling the custom dice to see what fossils you find. These could include trace fossils.
At the university library, you earn research cubes, which are needed to publish holotypes. And at the museum, you can trade fossils for other fossils or for research cubes.
Now, the final spot is for publishing journals. This lets you play a specimen card from your hand by playing the cost of the card in fossils and research. Also, you can add a trace fossil to any non-marine specimen for the cost of one additional fossil. This advances the field advancement track.
The field advancement track is the timer for the game. Once a set number of papers are published, the game ends immediately. The game can also end before this if a set number of global objectives are claimed. When moving up on the advancement track, there are spots that reset the museum and milestones. When you hit a milestone, all players get to choose an upgrade.
Each player gets the same set of six upgrades at the start of the game and will earn four of them by the end of the game. The upgrades do things like letting you hold more fossils, getting you additional research cubes, letting you look at more specimen cards, etc.
In addition to publishing a holotype, players can also use the publishing journal space to claim a global objective. Now, each objective lists a different requirement, and if a player has all of those requirements themselves on the papers they published, this action is free. If instead the objective is only filled through a mix of what yourself and the other players have published, then you have to pay 5 research cubes to cite the other player's papers.
At the end of the game, players score points for all of their published holotypes, their trace fossils played, the number of global objectives they have claimed, and their personal objectives. The player with the most points wins.
If you are interested in playing this with younger kids or just want a more family-friendly experience, the rules include a variant where you remove the personal objectives, you take out the global objectives and the milestones. And there are also rules for both a shorter and a longer game. So there's a lot of variability there.
There's just something about Holotype Mesozoic North America that just works. This game just feels good. It feels balanced and tight, and it flows really well. The mechanics are nothing new, but they work really well, and they tie in well to the theme. The actions you're taking just kind of make sense in regards to researching dinos and publishing papers.
The game's presentation gave me a bit of a pause, as while not amateur, it does have a bit of an educational feel. Now, that said, once the game started, you could tell it was a proper game and not some edutainment thing that had no real development. It's a solid game, and it is well linked to the theme.
I actually like the look and layout of this game, and I love how they made the meeples of various sizes, which just fits in with the rules mechanic and makes it easy and simple to remember.
Yeah, I like the educational feel. Like it's not like Genius Games. Genius Games publishes educational games that are like hard education games. I don't know how to describe it. They're more educational. They kind of feel like they're forcing the science on you. Whereas this just kind of gives you the fuel for the work that goes into dinosaur research. And I dig the cute thematic nods, like citing other people's work to publish papers.
Right. It's not in your face educational. It just does what it does and presents an educational information along the way in how the characters in the game interact with things and information on the actual holotypes themselves.
Yeah, the game managed to capture the attention of our dinosaur loving kid just by using proper dino names and eras and non-cartoony artwork. Like, she was really intensely just drawn to it. She's like, wow.
Now, there is one part of the game that might be a little too thematic, and that's the fight to publish and claim the global objectives. Claiming global objectives can get you a ton of points, especially if you claim 5. That is the max amount you can claim in a game. Competition for claiming these can be a big part of the game, but leads to some, like, just weird feeling gameplay. like paper players being able to publish a holotype, having all the resources, everything they need, but then holding off because they're worried they're just going to give someone else points through them stealing a global objective, or having a player just, instead of publishing their own papers and holotypes, just hoarding knowledge cubes just to be able to grab global objectives. It just feels off.
Yeah. And in real life, the urgency is to publish before someone steals your thunder with their own paper. So it's kind of a bit of a disconnect rather than holding off in the game. I think of my multiple plays of this game, it does stick out as the most frustrating mechanic in the game.
Okay, I know I'm in the minority here, but I actually sort of like that aspect of the game. I like the you're playing chicken and you're holding off on publishing and you're keeping track of what's going on with everyone else at the table. And then you realize, oh, if I jump in and publish right now, then they're not going to have enough cubes to grab that objective first. And I actually like that bit. It's like the next level strategy that only sinks in after you've played the game a few times.
Not a fan of that part myself, but I do love it. The other thematic tie-ins, like looking for fossils, that one in particular, I don't know, something about you randomly grab two cards and they're actual fossil sites around the world and you can read a little fact about them. And then you pick which site to go to and then you're grabbing dice and you got to roll the dice to find out what you get. I like the randomness of that, right? Like it's kind of a Euro game otherwise. It's a pure random factor here. And I've been very frustrated when I'm looking for, you know, Jurassic fossils and I keep drawing the wrong eras when I'm going to go for it. But to be fair, like finding fossils is an extremely random experience in real life. And I'm glad they didn't stick too close to the theme, because otherwise most of your digs would give you nothing.
And also, you're not micromanaging dig sites or anything like that. This is a very high level view of the work being accomplished. And thank you for that, because you could really get bogged down in the minutiae.
Now, another thing I want to call out is the awesome artwork here. I love the dino artwork on the cards. Like, this is some of the coolest looking dinos I've seen. Now, they did go with the lizard-like non-feathered version of dinos, which is how I grew up imagining them, so it works for me. Personally, though, just the board. The main board just, I don't need some pizzazz. It looks clinical.
Yeah, as I said, the presentation is nice, but that's about all. I think a more experienced publisher would have punched the game's visual design up a level, but it's not suffering. It's just a bit underwhelming, that's all.
Yeah, and I didn't see it. I actually like the board as it's laid out. I find it very functional, and I think it looks nice. So, yeah.
Now, one thing that I do think could be improved here is the iconography. This is mainly with the whole global objective things we were talking about earlier, because you need to be able to look around the table and see what other people have published at a glance. Now, the icons are pretty good, but they just could be better. Another thing that can help with this is how players organize their card. And I now tell everyone to organize their cards by era. But other times I played and said organize them by, you know, the other features like carnivore or herbivore. And I honestly wish the rulebook had a detailed, like, here's how to lay out your tableau to help with these things. And I've noticed that there's a fan who has actually created a free global objective tracker on BoardGameGeek, because technically it's not supposed to be secret information. Right. It's not supposed to be your skill at noticing things as part of the game, though, of course, we have played that way.
Yeah, I took a look at that tracker, actually, as part of my research into the ask earlier. And it was utilitarian, I guess, is the best way.
Yeah.
But kind of only barely. It was a bit of a pain, I could imagine, to use. And it took away part of that game that I think D likes, is that making sure that you're very aware of what everyone has done and what is out there and what that next global is going to be the first time someone puts a card down to match that missing thing. Mm-hmm. What I also noted while I was there is that there are also 104 fan-created dinosaurs available on BoardGameGeek. Oh,
that's cool. As long as they're all real dinosaurs, I didn't start making up...
what someone did was they did the dinosaurs of the world, because this focused on North America, and actually there'll be expansions coming for Europe monsters officially from Brexworks. But yeah, the fan stuff on BoardGameGeek is someone went and did not just North America, so you have the world's dinosaurs.
Yeah, I struggle with the iconography in this one. I have some vision issues, and I really have to, like, from across the table, I'm really struggling to make out what other people have laid out in their tableaus. I wasn't sure if it was just a me problem or an everyone problem. So I feel like if there were just more contrasting colors for the icons, something that you could really see at a glance from across the table, that would just make the game way more playable, at least for me. But I still love it. So
yeah, Deanna just said I still love it, right? So far, Holotype Mesozoic North America has been a hit. First played it with the family. Genevieve, our youngest daughter, decalled this auto array, loves it. She is super enthused by this game and loves reading it. And when we play with her, we have to write out what dinosaur we found and all the stats on the card before you publish your holotype. That's part of the game for her. It's also been a hit with lovely local public play events, playing with gamers of various experience levels. And the one I was surprised by is this managed to win over a local gamer who usually only plays cooperative games and just played this because there was nothing else starting at the time. Now, I think it fits, though, because while the game's competitive, except for that whole global objective sniping thing, it doesn't really feel nasty. Like, it's a worker placement game, but the bumping rules are really forgiving for a worker placement game, and it's very seldom someone takes the thing you want. That doesn't tend to happen in this game.
Yeah, I have to say, I really enjoyed playing this game. It was a solid and perhaps not awe-inspiring game. Again, I'm not a dino fan. I kind of skipped over the dino excitement as a kid. It never really did it for me. But it really plays into its own strengths and ends up being a really solid game to play.
Yeah, I feel like it's just a really great family weight game. That lack of nastiness that Mo mentioned earlier makes it good for, you know, while playing as a family and not getting siblings trying to kill each other. And yeah. It's also still a fun game for grownups to play.
So if you're into dinos, or more importantly, maybe your kids are into dinos, you should pick up Holotype. If your kids are younger, just stick to that Basil variant. It's the basic rules. And the nice part there is the game will grow with them, right? You can slowly add in more complexity. I would recommend starting with the milestones so that the game becomes asymmetric as you get playing. And then maybe throw in the personal objectives and maybe leave those global objectives out, only adding them in at the very end. Like, if you really want the family-friendly experience where you're not, there's no backstabbing, just ditch those global objectives.
Yeah, and for educators or classroom game collections, I can definitely see this playing out there. We talked a little bit about the age. It's listed as 14. It can probably go down a little lower, though. And there are those variants available for shorter play, longer play, less competitive play. And so you can really try and capture those kids while they're still in that dinosaur-crazed phase. To keep it going and give them a little bit of education along with their game.
Worker placement game fans should also check out Holotype. The neat part here, and it's kind of fascinating that it's this enjoyable, is it's not really doing anything new. I have played many worker placement games where you can bump other people's places if the rules are right. And I play games where you get things for collecting your workers. It actually reminds me a lot of Euphoria, build a better dystopia that way. But there's just something about the flow here you usually don't get with worker placement games. Like, turns are lightning quick. And that's what happened the last time we were playing a public play event. We kept having people saying, oh, it's my turn again, because they weren't expecting it to get back to them so quickly. And I've got to say, there's a nice feeling of accomplishment in this game when you've got that tableau in front of you of all the papers you put out. Like, you feel like you're accomplishing something.
Yeah, it's got that. It's quick and it's quick to set up and it's easy to explain, but it's still nice and meaty.
And because of that, just try Holotype if you can. Like, I think this is going to appeal to a fairly broad range of gamers. There's a lot here to like, and there's not a lot, I think, that'll turn people off. What I worry is people are going to dismiss it as a kid's game because it's about dinosaurs and marine reptiles. This is not just a kid's game, though I do think it would work with kids.
Well, that brings us to the end of our research paper on Holotype. I hope we've covered everything you want to know about this new-to-us game discovery. What did you learn today? Let us know in the comments below, or better yet, cite our work by sharing this review with your fellow gamers.
Game research and review can be a lot of work. Do you know what helps us get through the day? Coffee. Buy us a coffee at ao-fi.com/tabletopbellhop to keep us both caffeinated and motivated.
Save the world's artwork from The White Hand in the Art Project, a fantastic cooperative board game from The Op, who we have to thank for hooking us up with a review copy.
Now, The Art Project, that's spelled A.R.T. Project, comes from designers Florian Sirix and Benoit Turpin, and was originally published by Lumberjack Studio, which is an indie publisher from the Normandy region of France. It has been localized for North America by The Op, or USAopoly.
This cooperative game can be played with 1 to 6 players, but we found that there's a really sweet spot at 3 players. Games are surprisingly quick, with our 3-player games taking only about 45 minutes tops.
There are quite a few moving parts in The Art Project, so the age mac recommendation of 12+ seems about right.
So in the art project, you are part of an art rescue team, the art rescue team. That's where the ART comes from. It's a ragtag group trying to rescue the world's artwork from the evil white hand. You'll travel the world from US to Japan and even the Polynesian Islands. That came out weird. Polynesian Islands, working together to find clues and recover crates of stolen artwork, battling the white hand together with a team of allies. This cooperative game has players using cards to collect clues, move around the map, manage resources, and battle the white hand with a simple D6 dice pool mechanic. Can you recover all of the artwork before you run out of time or the white hand takes over too many cities?
And we cannot not mention this. One of the most impressive things about this game is the Vincent Dutrait artwork, which you can see throughout our The Art Project unboxing video over on YouTube.
And it's not just the artwork that's great here. The iconography is fantastic. The card design is super functional, and the wooden resource and white hand tokens are all uniquely shaped and colored. Honestly, some of the production quality in this game is the best we've seen.
You start the game by picking one of the six maps to play, each which offers a unique challenge. Each map has its own section of the rulebook that you'll use to set it up. This includes giving you a starting city and placing a bunch of white hand tokens on the cities on the map.
Each player chooses a character and takes a matching character card, D6 die, 3 health tokens, and places their playing piece onto the starting city. You load up the van with 3 of each resource. There's guns, fuel, and walkie-talkies. The clue deck gets set up, which involves inserting an end of the game card towards the bottom part of the deck, and you're ready to go.
Each turn, players will draw 2 cards from the clue deck in any order. You can see the city icons on the backs of each card, which may influence who you want to get what card.
Players look at their 2 cards and choose one to play. Now, each card has 3 parts. The first is the cost to play the card. These come from the 3 resources. If at any time a player wants or needs to spend a resource they don't have, they can spend a heart. They call this the golden rule because it comes up a lot.
The next part of the card shows city icons. For each of those, you will place a white hand onto the appropriate spot on the map.
Finally, there is the reward section to let you know what resources you're going to gain, which can include any of the 3 resources or hearts. Note, some cards only have 2 or 3 of these things on them. There are cards with no cost, cards with no cities.
Each card also has 1 or 2 clue icons on it. This is on both the front and the back of the cards. After everyone's played their cards, you're going to look at all the face-up cards on the table. And if you have 3 matching icons, you must place an art crate on the matching city.
Once everyone has played cards, players can move their pawns on the map. Cities are connected by lines on the map, and in general, moving from one city to a connected city costs 1 fuel, but this changes up depending on the map that you're on.
After everyone is moved, you resolve each city in the order you choose. If a player is with a crate and there are no white hands there, they take the crate. You win by collecting 7 crates. If there are white hands present, you must battle them.
Now, battling is dead simple. Each player present rolls their D6 die, and you're trying to get a total that's based on how many white hand tokens are in the city, plus a number based on how many crates your team has collected. The more crates you've collected, the tougher the white hand fights back. Now, guns can be spent, add 2 to your total, and dice can be rerolled by spending clue cards that have already been played.
You can get additional help by calling in allies. These are black D6 dice that can be used by any player, and you earn them by spending walkie-talkies. At the start of the game, these additional dice will cost 6 walkie-talkies, but then the price goes down as you collect more crates and more people join your cause.
If you win the combat, all white hand from that city are removed from the board, and you collect any crate that they were guarding. If you fail, the active player loses a heart.
Now, the player loses if any of them run out of hearts. You also lose if 4 cities fall to the white hand. At the end of each round, you check the board to see if any cities have been overrun, which happens if they have 5 or more white hand tokens on them. Once a city is taken, you can't move into it or move through it. Plus, any new white hand that would be placed there instead go on a special spot on the board and add to the strength of all white hand everywhere on the board, making all fights more difficult.
The game includes 4 difficulty levels, which just change how many hearts you start with. From easy with 4 to they did not know it was impossible, so they did it, with only 1 heart for each player.
In addition to these overall rules, each map has its own idiosyncrasies. For example, on the Egypt map, moving down the Nile is free, but moving up costs fuel, and all the cities are in a straight line. So losing 1 to the white hand can be devastating. It only costs one fuel to get anywhere in the Polynesian Islands, but there are two cities for each icon, and the White Hand shows up at both when a clue card is played. Scandinavian cities give you a bonus or a boon when collecting crates from each city and feature some routes that cost two fuel.
So the most striking thing about the art project is the art. Like, this game looks fantastic. Sean said it earlier. This has one of the best production qualities from a board game we've ever seen. And this isn't like some Kickstarter game with a bunch of stretch goals and upgrades and a deluxe edition. This is just what the retail version looks like. It includes little touches. Like, there's actually a postcard from the White Hand sitting posing on a beach with some artwork. And there's like a poster inside. And the game has fantastic card design.
Yeah, it's just gorgeous. The quality is really high and it's very cohesive. Like, everything just goes together and looks like it belongs together. But each map has its own theming and its own, while still feeling cohesive to the game. It's just beautifully well produced, and the iconography and everything is so simple and easy to read. It's just gorgeous to look at.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. Now, I guess that's to be expected from a game called Art Project, but I've seen games about art where the only attractive thing was the masterpieces of art they used in it. So it's not even a given that something called Art Project is going to be as beautiful as this game.
Now, the next thing is how much stuff you get in this box. Like, honestly, this game would be totally sellable, viable, and people would buy it if it came with one map. Having a two-sided map, of course, makes sense. You're going to put the board in. Why not put one on each side? But I would have been perfectly happy with that. But you don't just get two. You get three double-sided maps, each with its own special rules. Six total maps. Six new ways to play the game. That's the kind of thing that I expect to be separate expansions. Like, I would have had to go out and buy Map Pack 2, Polynesian Islands in Egypt. Right? But you get it all in one box, which is fantastic value.
Yeah, I was surprised by the second map and then shocked by the third one. And I mean, the third double-sided map, right? And each one is so unique and has such a unique look to it, unique theming, and unique rules, which it just makes for so many varied experiences in that one tiny box.
Now, as a result of all this content in the box, I somewhat doubt that there will be expansions for this. Yeah. But given the game mechanics available, I can't see any reason why fans wouldn't be able to whip up their own maps if they ever did finally grow tired of these six included options.
Now, I'll admit, I actually feel bad we didn't look that up with today's show topic that goes with this review. I bet you there are fan maps out there, and if there aren't, I'd be surprised. And as Deanna said, the great thing is that each map has its own rules, which makes the game much enjoyable because everyone feels different. Because as a cooperative game, like many cooperative games, this game is very much a puzzle, right? You're trying to solve the puzzle, and there are some random elements. And while each map presents a different version of that puzzle, while the overall mechanics are the same, what we described above applies to all the maps, each gives you a very different feel.
Because the game plays relatively quickly, I really love that we can sit down and go through a couple maps with a couple different feel, a different flavor, all in one sitting, right? It's like, oh, we beat this one. Okay, let's go try this one. All right, well, we came close. Let's do this one a second time. All right, now let's move on to a third map. You know, like, I like that. Not that one is necessarily harder than the other. They're just different.
Yeah, they aren't huge changes, but given how tough the game is, you don't need a big change to really shift the balance. The fact that they did manage to balance the six maps is impressive enough.
Overall, I like the mechanics here. Like, they're just solid mechanics. And what I like is this is a cooperative game that tends to lead to group discussion and not quarterbacking. Your main thing this happens in is that planning phase. It's the phase where everyone's got their cards, but they have to decide which to play. And some of this, like, there's some fascinating things going on there because every card has a cost in resources, and where you're placing the White Hand is also important, and resources are tight. So the order you play your cards in can be huge, as you often won't have the resources you need. And often, like, one of the players will be here going, you know, I can't play any of the cards in my hand without spending a heart. Well, if you play first and you get down a walkie-talkie, then I can play a card, which will give me the guns that you can play your card. And that's just like a normal part of the game. But then you got to watch while you're doing all this that you don't overrun a city with White Hand tokens. So you're not just watching the resources.
I think this is part of why I really prefer the game with three players, because once you get up to more people, it just becomes chaotic. That part where you're trying to coordinate everyone's move, it just becomes a little bit too much.
Yeah, indeed. Acting brashly without consulting the team can be disastrous here, as the resources are all shared. So one wrong move can mean the difference between success and being overrun.
And Dan has already called it, right? The one problem with all of this collaboration and this puzzle is that with more players, it gets to be too much. Another aspect of it is all the players act before the game goes, right? That's a pretty standard. Many cooperative games, the player acts and the board goes. The player acts, the board goes. That's not that in this game. In this game, everyone goes and the board does. Well, remember that rule where if you place five white hand in a city, it becomes overrun? Well, five players, that's five people adding white hand tokens all over the board. Plus the resource management, it's just harder. Like, yeah, there's tons of guns there at the start of your turn, but once four of the players go, you may not have the dice you need to be able to win that combat. The combos might be easier. Like the combats are definitely easier. And getting clues is easier, right? You can have crates pop up all over the place with five players, but it doesn't matter if the cities are becoming overrun before you can get there or if you don't have the guns to be able to do the fights. After many plays, we said it already, the sweet spot, we think, is three players. I also found it very enjoyable with two. It's a very quick game with two, so I did enjoy that. And I'll play it with four. But I honestly, at this point, have no interest in ever playing the art project with five or six again.
No, at six, it's just an exercise in misery.
Yeah, I haven't tried it too, but even at four, I'm hesitant to play again. While three, experienced players, while far from guaranteed, will make a good run in a tight game that doesn't overstay its welcome at the table.
Now, on the opposite end of thing, you can play this game solo, and it plays ridiculously quick slow. Now, solo rules are simple. You play one character, and you pick another character to be an ally. You get three cards each turn. You have to play two, but you get to choose the order. The rest of the game is basically the same, except your ally can't fight on their own. They can collect artwork, and they do contribute a die when fighting with you. Overall, I dig the art project. I liked it well enough at five and six. I actually enjoyed it then when we first played it and thought there was a lot of neat things going on. But then I fell in love with it once we reduced that player count down to three. Honestly, it's quite a few games recently we played where the player count had a huge impact on my enjoyment of the game. At three players, this is one of the best games I own, and it's up there in my list of top cooperative games of all time.
Okay, this is 2 weeks in a row where I'm saying that I like a cooperative game. So I feel like I may have to turn in my I hate cooperative games card.
It was shocking because I didn't hate the game when I first played it at those higher player counts. Quite the opposite. But then when we played it at three, it just became elevated. It was the right player count to me.
Yeah, I agree. So if you dig cooperative games, you're going to want to check out the art project. Again, it's the A.R.T, the ART project. While it features some familiar mechanics from games like Pandemic, there's enough other stuff going on that sets it apart. And one of the things that really sticks out to me is that dice-based combat system. If you like your, you know, rolling to hit style games, if you like that output randomness, that's actually in this game. And I think you'll dig that. That's something you don't see often in cooperative games.
If you want to work together to solve a puzzle, that's what's enjoyable here. If you look at it as a giant puzzle that you're trying to solve together with some randomness from dice and cards and whatever, but yeah.
And as Mo mentioned earlier, because of the hidden information on cards combined with the randomness of dice, it's just a little bit harder to have that quarterback problem you often see in cooperative games. Not impossible, but reduced.
Now, another group that I think will pick this up, because I know you're out there, hoarders and dragons who like to look at their hordes. If you collect great looking games, you're going to want this on yourself. Vincent Dutrait outdid himself with the art on this game.
Yeah, you could put these game boards on the wall in the house of any gamer and they wouldn't look out of place.
Yeah, it's so pretty. If you normally don't like cooperative games, I recommend you give the art project a try, especially at lower player counts. This one hits a little differently from most cooperative games and it may just win you over.
Now, localizing the art project is actually part of a new initiative from the OP or USAopoly in an attempt to expand their strategy game offering, featuring games with a bit more meat on them than they usually produce. And to that end, I think they nailed it with the art project. Well, yeah, it might be a little heavier than what they usually offer. I think the feel of this game and the flow really fits with their catalog, and I can't wait to see what the OP has for us next.
That's it for our look at the Art Project, a clever cooperative game with fantastic production values and huge replayability through its six different scenarios. We ended up getting more than we expected from this one. What's a game that you've played that had way more content than you expected? Where you find stuff you usually find in expansions is right there in the original game box. Tell us all about it in the comments below.
Or head over to Tabletop Bellhop Discord and let us know there. And you can find us at discord.tabletopbellhop.com. Make a great game even better with the Satellites and Commanders expansion for the Artemis Project from Grand Gamers Guild. We have to thank for hooking us up with a review copy of this expansion and also for being a sponsor of the Tabletop Bellhop Gaming Podcast, though that actually happened after we got this review copy.
The Artemis Project Satellites and Commanders is an expansion from designer Daniel Roki. Features artwork from Christian Romero. You'll need a copy of the Artemis Project to play this. Just in case you don't know it, though, the Artemis Project is one of the best dice-based worker placement games we played. So be sure to check out our Artemis Project review, then come back and see what we have to say about this expansion.
Satellites and Commanders keeps the same player count of 1-5, but is considered best with 4. And it does up the playtime of the Artemis Project by a bit, maybe by 10 to 15 minutes per player.
It also increases the weight by a small amount as it adds at least 5 new options on every player turn.
So Satellites and Commanders adds 2 new things to the games of the Artemis Project. Can you guess what they are? Right? First, you got satellites. They dock with off-board locations called chariots, which can influence the main board actions. Then you have commanders. These are a new type of colonists that you can promote your existing folk into at the cost of an expedition badge. These are powerful as they count as wild cards and can be used to bump the value of your dice without affecting the dice rank.
Now we have the deluxe edition of Satellites and Commanders, which came from the Kickstarter and which you can still get direct from Grand Gamers Guild. The only thing that sets this version apart from the retail are the cute little plastic satellite die holders.
And there are 3D models on BoardGameGeek for printing your own satellites. Now, okay. Get a look at these fantastic official satellites for in our Artemis Project Satellites and Commanders unboxing video on YouTube, which is also worth watching, even if you're considering the retail version, since our box includes everything in the retail box as well as these extra satellites.
You can also just buy these satellites direct from Grand Gamers Guild if you just really want the plastic ones, too. Now, at first, I thought those satellites were a bit over the top and ridiculous, but you know what? I don't know. There's something about this game with its chonky, like, first player marker. It's just kind of an aesthetic to it. But once I picked one up and put a dice in the satellite, I was like, no, I'm sold. That just feels good. The other component quality is also great. The new chariot tiles are kind of nice. They go in the corners of the board, give me a bit of a talisman flashback. There's new buildings, expedition and event cards, custom dice. Similar to the base game, iconography on these new components is excellent, though I do wish the text on the chariot tiles was bigger.
It's not that bad, though, because there's only 4 of them. You pick them up, you read them all at the beginning of the game, and then you pass them around and set them down the corner. So that one doesn't bother me too much. And I know when we first cracked this game open, I saw those chunky satellites and I thought they were the silliest looking thing I'd ever seen. And they wouldn't. I thought it would make the expansion not fit in the base box. But I actually love them. They are super utilitarian because they are at a nice angle when they're sitting. You can clearly see the die number on them from across the board. I actually like the way that they're angled, the way they sit, the way they fit onto the chariots. I actually like everything about the silly components.
Yeah, even in good light, you really do kind of need to read the chariots before the game, maybe even make a note. Otherwise, you may keep asking to see them throughout. If you're a regular player, though, I expect you'll learn them and it won't be a problem soon enough. You'll just know, oh, that's the one that does that.
Adding Satellites and Commanders to the Artemis Project is pretty simple. You randomly draw chariot tiles until you have one for each corner of the board. Place the new Academy tile on top of the Academy spot. Mix the new buildings, events, and expedition cards in with the originals and then set up the game as normal.
No, when playing with this expansion, you need to play on harsh mode, meaning you do not add 2 extra resources to the vents and the quarry during board setup. As for the satellites, you use 1 less than the number of players.
Now, there's an optional rule in this expansion I like, and I've seen it in a few other expansions before, but I always enjoyed this. If you really want to experience the new stuff, what they recommend is instead of just mixing in the new buildings and stuff, remove an equal amount of the existing stuff beforehand. That way you have a better chance of seeing the stuff in the expansion.
Yeah, I love that because when I get a new expansion, I'm all excited to see what it does. I like that idea. All of the standard rules from the Artemis Project apply here. During the placement phase, players now have the option to claim a satellite. They place a die onto an unclaimed satellite and then place that satellite into an open chariot. Or they can steal a satellite that's already at a chariot by playing a lower die than the one that's currently there. And if this replaces an opponent's base die, they go up on the exposure track. But if it replaces their satellite die, they don't. Mm-hmm.
When going through the resolution phase, you now start with the chariot on the top right section of the board, which influences the expedition phase. If a player has a satellite there, they get to use the effect on that chariot. If it's empty, it's skipped. You continue going around the board, resolving things as normal, but stopping at each chariot space before resolving the actions on that next side of the board.
So Satellites and Commander comes with a total of four different chariots for each of the four corners of the board, each with its own ability. Now, the value of the die in the satellite affects how powerful the ability will be. Now, the top right chariot affects expeditions, and some of the abilities we've seen is getting bonus victory points if you're first in an expedition, or letting you move a die from one expedition to another before you resolve that area.
So if that's not clear, we're talking about four different chariots in one corner, and then another four over here, not a total of four for the game. Because as Mo was reading it out, I thought you might not be getting it clear. There's actually quite a bit of variability here. The bottom right chariot will affect the vents in the quarry and includes things like getting to take resources that are left over after these spots resolve or getting to exchange resources. And the bottom left chariot affects the gantry with abilities like getting to buy buildings from the top of the deck or getting resources back if you build more than one building.
The top left chariot affects either the doorstep or the academy, with abilities like getting to train your existing colonists for free or getting free colonists. During the upkeep phase, players have to decide if they want to keep their satellites or not. This costs two minerals to keep and has you replace your placement die with one of the new satellite dice, which is rolled up to the next highest number. Then, all satellites orbit the board one position, moving to the next chariot clockwise around the board.
Commanders are a bit simpler. The academy spot on the board has been changed, so it now has one spot to train your colonists like the old rules, but a new spot for upgrading a colonist to a commander. You place a die there along with one of your colonists, and each colonist has a value, which is added to the value of your die. When you resolve the spot, it's only the player with the highest total that can actually promote to their colonist to a commander. Everyone else suffers one exposure.
Commanders, once acquired, are very powerful and versatile. They can occupy any spot in any building and count as a colonist shown. They also count as all colonist types for any other ability that's based on the number where you have to have a specific type.
The other thing you can do with commanders is you can include them with a die you are about to place. They increase the value of that die by two, but do not change the relative position of the die, which is based on the pips shown. So you can place a three in the vents, but with a commander, you will get five, while still drafting before anyone who plays four or higher.
Now, if that's not enough, each commander also gets their own free swap during the upkeep phase. You pick which color they are when scoring surface buildings, and then you get to pick again when counting up sets of colonists at the end of the game.
There are also rules for including this expansion when playing solo, but I'm sorry to say we didn't actually try this. You're going to have to discover that one on your own.
One thing I know that Mo mentioned during the unboxing is that he thought you could only use part of this module, like only use the satellites or only the commanders. That's not actually the case. At least it's not designed to be used that way. This is not a modular expansion. It's all or nothing, satellites and commanders.
So I'm sure you could house rule it. Like, you'd have to go through the buildings and, like, if you don't want to use the satellites, pull out all the buildings referencing satellites and the events referencing satellites, or you could do it the other way around. Now, I don't remember if there are actual cards that reference both, but if there were, you'd have to pull those out too.
Yeah, given the relative power of each portion of the expansion, I have a hard time believing it would actually be balanced, but your mileage may vary.
So getting to our thoughts about this expansion, and I got to say, I think all three of us agree this is a welcome addition to the Artemis Project. It takes a game we like and adds both breadth and depth. There are more options and more strategic ways to play. It also reduces some of the randomness and to me just makes the game better. There's more randomness mitigation. The new buildings and events make things a little less predictable, which I think is a good thing, because at the high player count before, you'd see every building and you'd see every expedition. Now, you never quite know what you're going to get. You're getting more options. And now I find low rolls are more valuable than ever. So there's more things you can do with those low value dice with the satellites, because stealing satellites requires lower dice. It also felt like there was more room for mistakes, that if you messed up one thing, there were more ways to recover.
There was more reasons to actually want to be first player and not hope you were actually last player, because being able to sneak in and steal a satellite can be kind of cool. There's just a lot of neat little bits being added on here, and it just felt like more Like without really changing the core of the game.
Yeah, the commanders in particular, I think, was the most beneficial in balance. It almost feels like something that should have been there from the start. But if it's had on its own, I think it would have been too powerful. So it needed that balance of the satellites.
And I like the satellites myself. I think they're really neat. I like that hard decision at the end of the round to keep them or not. And this was even more interesting once we started to see buildings that rewarded you for having an active satellite and expedition rewards that were based on satellites. So sometimes there was encouragement to keep them going longer than you might have. And also encouraging your opponents to steal them for you from you before you got those benefits.
Yeah, I have to say, I wasn't as excited about the commanders as I am about the satellites. The satellites really made this expansion for me. And I think if it was modular, I would be leaving the commanders out.
Yeah, the problem I saw, though, that is only one cherry is super useful and the others are less beneficial. Again, and that all comes down to the combination of which ones turn up. Mm-hmm. It does become a bit of a knife fight for that one location, and the rest are mostly ignored unless you happen to have a special need, like a building that requires you to have a satellite for any other purpose.
And Deanna called this out. The other thing I really like is the number of different satellites, because you've got two-sided styles for each corner. So four different possibilities in each corner and 16 different powers. And I think my math on this is right. I think that's 4 factorial. Which gives you 256 different possible combinations of chariots. So it's unlikely two games ever end up with the same mix.
As I said, variability.
Yeah, I think your mileage will probably vary with some chariot combinations being better than others. And there may end up being, you know, you end up with your favorites and you're like, hey, can we play with chariot setup X today?
And now, unlike Deanna, I love the commanders. I think they're awesome. I like having them. I like the way they make you feel less constrained. You have more options. The game's a little less tight, but in a good way. Plus, they help with some of the randomness mitigation. And while I just dig the chunky meeples, I don't know, to me, they look like Judge Dredd with the big shoulder pads. And that makes me smile.
Oh, Judge Dredd. I love that. You know, I keep ignoring the commanders and you keep winning with the expansion while I keep not winning. So maybe that's a me problem.
Maybe.
Yeah, as I said, I think they suit the game very nicely, adding a sort of finishing polish while being balanced in their strength by having those satellites for everyone else as well.
Now, something else I do like from this expansion, I think is a big balancing compared to the scoring in the original game that mainly comes from the commanders, upgrading commanders, but some of the new events and buildings do it too, is a way to spend those expedition badges. In the original game, badges always felt like something that you had two choices on. You either went all in on trying to do as many expeditions as you could, get as many as you could, and tried to get those high scoring values of like 8 or more, or you didn't bother with them. You barely touched them. You just made sure you had the bare minimum of 2 so you don't lose 3 points. I love that this expansion gives you reasons to go on expeditions and worthwhile ways to spend them.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest change here, is that the badges become a commodity that you are spending. And that balance between not wanting to spend too many because you don't want to go negative, or maybe you do, maybe it's worth it, you know. But it's an expensive thing to earn to be able to play in game. And that was the biggest change.
Yeah, as well as the more ways to get them, which gives you those more ability to get the big badge points at the end of the game, so much more reasonable than the struggle it had been to get them. That is, if you can resist spending them.
So honestly, that if you like Artemis Project, get Satellites Commanders. It's that simple. It makes a great game better. The only downfall I can find with this expansion at all is that it makes the game longer. But I think that extra time's worth it.
Yeah, 100%. If you have the Artemis Project, just go pick this up.
Yeah, if you've played the Artemis Project and thought it was a good, solid game, but not one you're going to be seeking out playing on your own, I recommend giving it another shot with Satellites and Commanders. It may just be enough to change it from a game you like well enough to one you really enjoy.
If you don't own the Artemis Project but are intrigued by it, if we've sold you through the review of Artemis Project in this one, I would recommend picking them both up at once, right? I don't often say get the base game and the expansion at the same time, but I would. I know Mark likes to bundle them at cons. If you ever see Grand Gamers Guild booth at a con, and there's an offer right now at grandgamersguild.com where you can get an Artemis all-in bundle. Now, that does include the Artemis Project, Satellites and Commanders, but also a standalone game called the Artemis Odyssey. That's a retheme of the classic game Ad Astra, But we haven't gotten that one to the table yet. So I'm going to guess it's probably worth it, but we haven't tried that one ourselves.
And remember, when you do go shopping at Grand Gamers Guild, be sure you use our code BELLHOP, BELLHOP, and save 10%.
Also, if you happen to have or can easily get the retail version of Satellites and Commanders, you can just get the upgraded satellites direct from Grand Gamers Guild.
That's all we have to say about the Artemis Project, at least for now. So far, Satellites and Commanders is the only expansion, and a very solid one, that we strongly recommend fans pick up. Well, I wouldn't say this is a must-have expansion, because it doesn't fix the base game, it just makes it better.
What's an expansion you picked up for a game that just took that game you loved and made it a bit better? Not something you think everyone must have, or that makes an unplayable game playable, just something that takes what a game offers and improves on it enough to make that expansion worth it. We'd love to hear all about it in the comments.
If you enjoyed our The Artemis Project coverage, including this expansion review, be sure to heart, like, or thumbs up this post wherever you found this. Even better, share a link with your game group, family, or friends. Help us get the word out about this and other great hobby board games. Well, that was the double bell.
That means our shift's coming to an end and we're going to have to lock the lobby doors.
Before we start locking things down, let's take a moment to thank a selection of our Tabletop Bellhop Patreon patrons.
Roger Malosh, thank you, Roger.
David Miller Jr., thank you, David.
Ron F., thank you, Ron.
Kat and Tori, happy 1 year of being a parent.
Jeff and Sheila Seuss, thank you.
Brian Kurtz, thank you, Brian.
Your first stop to finding us should be at tabletopbellhop.com, but we're all over the web as Tabletop Bellhop, one word, and on your podcatcher of choice as the Tabletop Bellhop Gaming Podcast.
If you made it this far, you should join our Patreon. You can find that at patreon.com/tabletopbellhop. There you can get a heads up on our Wednesday show topics, check out our show notes, and get access to exclusive first look reviews, where I share my thoughts on games after only one or two plays. Most recently, I published one on Tiger Stripes, the card game. Features some games we may never get to a full review.
And that's all for tonight. You can also support us by giving us a thumbs up, a like, leave a comment, or better yet, tell your friends and fellow gamers about our show.
For the Tabletop Bellhop Gaming Podcast, I'm Sean.
I'm Deanna.
And I'm Mo.
Thank you.
And game on.
Find full reviews, show notes, and more at tabletopbellhop.com. Graphic design by Brian Weiss at RPG & Co. Music is Nimbus by Eveningland. The podcast is released under a Creative Commons attribution license.